Right, good evening everybody. You've got me again for a little bit. Can I suggest that we start again? We're meant to be finishing around about 8-ish, I think, and we're running a little bit late here. So I'm going to chair the next session, chair loosely. I'm going to invite, we're going to have three people coming up again. I'm going to ask them some questions about some stuff. We'll try and keep this quick fire, fairly short and snappy, but please come in with any questions, anything that you want to ask. It's your final chance this evening to ask about Brexit. Right, so can I invite Steve, first of all, who's the head of the business schools at the University of Sussex. And Steve, one of the things that we were working on, and we produced a paper on this about a year or so ago, was to do with the impact of Brexit on different types of industries. And one of the things that we found, which we thought was quite interesting, was that when we broke it down into some detail, the results seemed to indicate that industries that were higher technology, higher R&D, higher skill-intensive industries are probably more vulnerable to Brexit outcomes. So that's my lead-in to you as to, in a post-Brexit world, what implications does this have for R&D policy?
So thanks, Michael. So let me just, is this on now? There it is.
Is that right? Oh yeah, like on. Okay. So where are we now? The UK spends, to give you some context, the UK spends about 1.7% of GDP on research and development. That's government and corporate. The ambition is to get to 2.4 by 2027, although that date's undoubtedly slipped, and then to get push onward to about 3.
I assume those targets were there anyway.
Those targets arose from a December 2017 Industrial Strategy 2027, which, although not derived directly from Brexit, really does speak to what will we do when we are out of this very stable, very large trading relationship with the EU. I do feel a need to sort of rehabilitate Singapore a bit after it was maligned. To me, that's what Singapore on sea is. Singapore is a very, very planned economy with a very clear view about identifying industries of the future and pouring money into them. So what's implied in the government's industrial strategy is really effectively a doubling of our research spend over a very short period of time. Your work on the briefing paper was actually really, really important, because one of the things we do know about corporate R&D expenditures in this country is they are made overwhelmingly by foreigners. And British firms, i.e. domestic British firms, do not generally spend a lot on R&D. It's actually international firms coming here, typically accessing our university base, and we don't have a good answer, and the strategy doesn't have an answer as to why you would suddenly incentivize British firms to be much more invested in R&D than they currently are.
So, was the industrial strategy at all clear about the way in which it would try and increase the levels of R&D spend? Is this to do with encouraging the private sector in and of itself, businesses, to do that R&D? Is this to do with matched funding? Is it subsidies? Is it greater engagement and liaison with universities? What is the plan here, to the extent that there is one?
Principally the latter. Universities were central to the original draft. There's a lot of emphasis on increasing amounts of money going into universities. So I actually, to Adam's point earlier, universities have done relatively well out of some of this. The Autumn Statement, now about 5 years ago, increased basic research spending by £5 billion, £1 billion a year, and it ends in 2021. So that was just a sort of precursor. But the current strategy is rather conventional. It is about giving universities more money for translational research, spinning out more companies. So there's a very heavy emphasis on new venture creation as distinct from moving existing companies up into different markets. And there's really very little said about services. It's, again, very much about making stuff and making high technology products. Now, that might be because services might not require the kind of heavy investment that manufacturing does. But nonetheless, it's somewhat troubling that there isn't much to be said about service innovation.
But is that also because much of the industrial strategy seems to be focused on particular target areas, be this aerospace or smart technology and so on?
Now that's true. The original target areas and target themes were, again, they're quite common actually internationally, thinking again of Singapore, the aging society, mobility, renewable energy. These are all laudable things. And there were targets for individual sectors. So aerospace is one, life sciences is another. And there was also a sector deal for artificial intelligence. So there is some target that there were, that still are, but we haven't seen the money come through yet. There, the expectation is there will be targeted interventions in a number of sectors.
Can we go back to the question, the statement you made a moment ago about how British companies actually are not the major investors in technology and in research in this country? That it's foreign companies. Can you comment on whether that might be some cultural British cultural business idea that British businesses have a very bottom line next 3 months sort of thing? Why is it they're not investing compared to foreign companies which come here, are promised something, and then set up an entire investment scenario?
So there is indeed an academic explanation going back historically about the nature of British capitalism emphasizes shareholder returns above all, and that is undoubtedly true. It's there in the literature. I would suggest there's another explanation, though, more recent, which is why companies would invest here to begin with. Principally, a lot came because we were a base for access to the European market. So their investments are of a different type. So obviously Japanese companies, German companies, a lot of it was medium, intermediate goods for onward export to the continent. So I don't think it's necessarily so much cultural, but rather why these firms, by definition, invested much later, why they came in when they did. And so they had a different composition to their investments than British firms anyway.
So is it very likely that all of that investment would just be moved straight to the Republic of Ireland as an English-speaking entry?
Not necessarily. We do have a few things that are going for us, right? We do have a very strong research base. I mean, it is the case that in terms of European research funding, Europeans are disappointed we're leaving, not just because they're going to miss us, but because we have an astonishingly strong research base here. They are losing out on that, so they have an incentive to come to some sort of agreement. So they're not happy about this. We still have, although with each passing day it gets more difficult to sort of tell yourself this, we still have a relatively well-run political and legal system. We have well-understood and internationally recognized IP laws. We are still, on balance, well-governed. And I do think, provided we maintain that reputation, we will still get a share of this. But it won't be for access to the European market. It will be for some other reason, because we have particular skills and talent here that makes us an attractive destination.
Any other questions? Yes.
In the context of R&D, it's the patents that are important. Do you think patent law will change after Brexit or that?
Good question. I don't know. I don't even know. I wouldn't disagree, but I think one of the concerns that I have about this strategy is whether the British labour force, and this gets back to, I guess, the point made earlier, Britain has a labour force that in general is not well equipped to deal with high technology industries outside certain areas. I mean, why are we good at pharmaceuticals? There are a few interrelated reasons. One, we have a very good research base that discovers pharmaceuticals, drugs. Synthesizing a pharmaceutical is relatively straightforward once you do it. The hard bit is on the R&D side. So it suits an economy where intermediate skills in the economy are lacking. And of course, we have the NHS to help with procurement. So going forward, I don't know that we have the labor force that would match the kind of demand for intermediate skills and technical skills that we might need going forward. That's a sort of evasion of your question, Ilona, I appreciate. But no, I don't honestly know. I don't think it would not be in our interest to develop a patent regime that was dramatically different from the one we have now. just impose costs.
Yes.
You mentioned that, like, the really nice idea of like intermediary skills and raising that sort of capital in the UK. Do you feel like there's almost an infrastructural problem within the UK itself, across maybe the universities or in a wider sort of sense, that is stopping British people accessing those skills, which I think it purely stems from that idea of cultural British capital?
I don't think it's cultural. I think there is a problem with further education and intermediate skills in the economy. I don't think it's uniquely British. I happen to be dual British Canadian, and I can tell you that having been in Canada last week, there is the exact same debate about whether we shovel too much money into universities vis-a-vis further education. It was stunning to me how actually you just could have swapped in Canada for the UK. So it's not unique. A lot of countries do grapple with this.
I think it's a follow-up question.
Sorry, it's a fair answer to that. Do you feel that the sort of like profit-seeking and like rent-seeking motives of either like the electing the UK shareholders and the dividends that, or even itself institutionally within the UK, you, for example, an exorbitant amount to be paid for vice chancellor positions, do you think that that sort of country can any sense at all to the university?
It's gone now, so that's
I know what Adam's paying. I have my own views about whether, given the value, given the turnover of the university, that's actually exorbitant. So the general question, we have seen inequality grow across developed states dramatically over the past like 3-4 decades, and there is a range of explanations for it. Some are technological. Some in this country deal with the unintended consequences of transparency. We have never been more transparent about executive pay of all sorts, and that transparency itself has not made a blind bit of difference to restraining rates of pay. Who thought that would happen? So I think there's a mix, and there might be a cultural dimension, but this has occurred generally in countries as far-ranging, to varying degrees, to be fair. From countries as far-ranging as Sweden to the United States.
Let me turn the discussion a little bit back to Brexit, and perhaps a final question before we move on to our next special invited guest, which is, what do you think are the main challenges for R&D policy arising from Brexit? How does it make it more difficult?
It makes it more difficult because we can't make the downstream market argument. Right. So that's one thing.
So can you just explain what you mean by
that? What I mean by that is if the card can no longer be located in Milton Keynes and you can sell to Germany, as he says. So there is that downstream argument that is more difficult. I don't think there will be enormous difficulties in terms of attracting talent. I do think we will have a problem of why the UK, right? Let's go back to Singapore. Let's go back to the United States. Lots of countries are relatively attractive places to do R&D now, and provided they have stable and reliable governance regimes, they can do quite well. So I think we do lose a major card in terms of the market, because that argument falls away. So the main challenge, I think, we will have to think about how, sorry to go keep going back to Singapore, how we have an answer to why wouldn't I locate my biomedical facility in Singapore as distinct from the UK.
Okay. I did say it was going to be the last question, but I can't resist a follow-up. You talked about stable governance regimes and so on, but what about stable trade regimes? Do you not think the lack of certainty about the future trade regime of the UK may be a disincentive, or to what extent do you think there might be a disincentive to investment generally, but therefore also to investment in R&D intensive industries?
No, I take the point, Michael. I think it clearly is a disincentive. The UK is going to be get Brexit done is, of course, a complete misnomer. We are just getting one phase of this long process done. And no, companies that have choices are still not, and they'll be very polite about it, but they are still going to say, well, let's see at least the trajectory. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you.